There was a man by the name of Jones who owned a VW. And if you've owned one as long as I have, you realize that if you have one, it's mostly in their garage getting worked on and not so much in yours. Well, Jones had a little quirk about his VW. He liked to work on it himself. As a matter of fact, when he would drive up to that white line where no one is to cross, he would get in there and get behind the car with the mechanic trying to help him out, asking questions, bugging the mechanic. One day, Jones drove up to the white line, and the VW mechanic, who'd gotten him every time for the last year and a half, saw him coming. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. The mechanic had already had a horrible day. He saw Jones coming. Jones got out. He got in the car, drove past the white line. Jones is standing there, but Jones didn't wait. He trotted right behind him, past the white line, into the stall. The mechanic got out. There's Jones, asking questions, already had the hood up, talking to him. You think it could be this? What about this plug over here? I've read that this could really cause a lot of engine damage if you don't have this plugged in exactly right. The mechanic said, "Hey, Jones, I can't take it today. I cannot take it today. I mean, I've had it to here. It's only 9 o'clock, I realize, but I can't handle you today. Let's play a game." Jones said, "A game?" He said, "You want to play a game?" "Yeah, that'd be great. We've never done that here before, have we?" He said, "No, it's a new thing we're doing here at the VW mechanic area." He said, "I'll tell you what, I'm going to draw a circle on the other side of the white line." So he went over and he drew this big circle. And he said, "I'll bet you while I'm working on your car, you cannot stay inside this circle. I'll bet you can't do it." He said, "Terrific." And Jones jumped in the circle. The mechanic went over to Jones's car in that stall. He'd had it. He'd gone berserk. He knew what was happening in his heart. He didn't care about this job. He didn't care about anything anymore. He picked up a sledgehammer. He raised it above the car to bring it down to see what Jones would do. Jones had a smirk on his face, starting to laugh. This made the mechanic furious. And so he came down, whoop! Hit that car right down through the top. He looked around and Jones is starting to laugh now, still standing inside the circle. It made the mechanic go berserk. He took his hammer and he beat and he beat and he beat and he beat and he got that car down to about a 4-inch plane. Jones is now holding his side, falling to the ground inside the circle, laughing himself silly. He just can't believe it. The mechanic was overwhelmed. He had destroyed the car. Nothing could ever work again. He looks at Jones in this crazy hyena laugh sort of thing over here in the middle of the circle. He picks up that sledgehammer and walks back over to Jones. He said, "Jones, I don't understand. I have exhausted myself destroying your car. I have completely destroyed it where no one will ever fix it again, my friend. And you sit here in this circle laughing like a hyena, going berserk over here. I can't believe you're just laughing. What are you doing?" And Jones could hardly get it out. He said, "While you were beating up on my car, I stepped out of the circle 3 times. Well, Jones had a problem, all right? His problem is that basically he was playing games while something serious was going on. That's what I think is happening in marriage today. We're playing so many games. Everyone's playing their role. People are concerned about their image and how they're pulling it off and what they're doing. And a woman makes sure that she's a woman. And a man trying to figure out what a man does. Everyone's looking for the role, the game. And yet very serious things are happening in our world, especially in the area of family and marital relationship. I think one of the greatest problems that brings about battlegrounds of marriage, and they're out there. As a matter of fact, University of Rhode Island came out with a study about 4 years ago that said that the most dangerous place to be in the United States today, outside of riots and war, is the American home. Because somebody's going to get it there. There's so many people who are mad there. They're angry. They don't know what to do with their life. Their life's not working, so they're so frustrated, and they're lashing out and hurting one another instead of making it work. One of the greatest problems, I think, is that we don't talk. One study came out a few years ago that says that the average communication time of father to his children is somewhere between 20 and 40 seconds a day. 20 and 40 seconds a day, the average communication time. I mean, it doesn't take much to say, how was your day, son? Oh, good. And would you pass the butter, please? And then we're into 9 seconds right there. 20 to 40 seconds. It's what we don't say. And so many times, especially in the parent-child relationship, when you see and listen to yourself just a little bit about what you say when you're talking to your children, how many times do you come across so negative? If you listen from their vantage point, you come across so negative, you wonder why they have a bad attitude sometimes. There's a great story that talks about non-communication. This man wanted to go into the priesthood, and he wanted to go into the best, most rigorous priesthood of all. And so he entered this monastery where they were only allowed to speak two words every 10 years. He entered into this silence for 10 years. They brought him in to have his interview at the end of his first decade, and they said, okay, Brother Benjamin, what do you have to say? He said, well, I've got this to say, basically. Bed hard. That's good. Write that down. Bed hard. They sent him back for another 10 years. At the end of the next 10 years, they asked him for his next interview to give only two words. And he said, food bad. They sent him off for 10 more years. Now we've gone through 3 decades. He's coming in for his third interview. And the head of the monastery said, Brother Benjamin, what is it that you would like to give us as your two words? Brother Benjamin said, I quit. The head man said, doesn't surprise me a bit. You've done nothing but complain for 30 years. Isn't that the way it works, though, in communication? It works because we don't communicate enough. And because we don't communicate enough, then what we've said wasn't too swift. How many times have I said things to my wife that I wish I could take back? How many times have I wished I'd said something and didn't say it? Oh, we don't talk enough. We don't get it out. Relationships are kind of screwy anyway. Have you noticed? I love the film Annie Hall, one of Woody Allen's best, I think. The whole film was on relationships and how relationships are irrational. They're painful. They hurt. They seem crazy sometimes. And yet, we seem to go after. He ends the whole movie with this one story. I love it. He says the man went into the psychiatrist and said, hey, doc, my wife thinks she's a chicken. He said, well, go back and tell your wife she's not a chicken. There's no way she's a chicken. You tell her she's not. He said, no, I can't do that. He said, what do you mean? You tell her she's not a chicken. She's not a chicken. I can tell you that. She's not a chicken. Go tell her she's not. He said, I can't do that. He said, why can't you do that? He said, because I need the eggs, you see. Isn't that the case? Relationships are irrational. They don't seem to work. They have so much pain. We could do so much better without. I've often said that it'd be so much better in any kind of business, in any kind of relationship, in any kind of organization, if you could just do it without people. It's the greatest asset and the greatest liability. As a matter of fact, you're your greatest asset and you're your greatest liability. They're irrational, and yet we need the eggs. There are 11 battlegrounds that seem to hit the spectrum of everything I've seen in thousands and thousands of marriages as I've dealt with them over the years. I think this sums it up into 11. We may add another one before the day is out when we hear some of your sharing, but at least 11 of them. And the first one is the impossible no-way marriage. The impossible no-way marriage. I see this continually, where one person doesn't want to work it out. Where one person just refuses to change. You see, we get this in our heads. We get this in our heads that we have married somebody that will be just like we married them forever. It's not true. We did not marry somebody that will stay static forever. They will not be that way forever. They will change. And what I find is when people have crises in their lives, they come together into a marital counseling situation and they want some kind of instruction, and one of them doesn't want to buy it. I continually hear from people, they say, isn't there a better plan? Could you give me a better plan on this? Is there another counselor that we could see? Well, there are dozens of them. But they're looking for another plan. They don't like what they're hearing. The reason many times that marriages do not work is because one or both don't want to make it work. The impossible no-way marriage. I am not willing to change. You're not like you used to be. Of course you're not. Of course you're not. Many people come in to see me and they say this. I don't like how our marriage is right now. And after I hear the story, I agree. Terrific response. I don't like it either. Secondly, they don't see how it could get any better. And that's where the trap is. The impossible no-way marriage. The second one is marriage without a license. I like this one. Marriage without a license is where some people believe that by living together, they can make their marriage much, much more healthy. They can really pull off a dynamic called marriage just by living together. Forget the paperwork. We'll do that later. You know, that there's one kind of person that comes in to see me quite often, and this person has, the problem is just like it's so evident. It's almost like a girl walks into the office and has a dagger in her chest, and blood is dripping out, and she feels pain there, and she walks in and she says, you know, I don't know, maybe you can help me with this problem, Tim. I've heard you really help people. I have this basic problem. I have a pain here in my chest area, and I don't know what's wrong. And so I say something very insightful, like, have you thought about pulling out the dagger there in your chest? Oh, I didn't know there was a dagger there. It's that obvious. A woman comes in and she says, you know, I feel depressed. I feel out of it. I don't seem to be able to make a commitment to this man anymore. I'm not sure he's made a commitment to me. He never did. You see, he's got it made. Charlie over here is enjoying the friendship and the relationship, and he doesn't want to make a commitment to that woman. And she's wondering why she feels so non-female, why she feels so non-person-oriented, why she feels so out of it, why she feels so gooey and depressed and down. It's because there's no commitment there. There's nothing there. It's marriage without a license. It doesn't work. Some have gone beyond 9 months. Most stay in there between 6 and 9 months before they start shooting at one another. Gets to be very exciting. The third battleground, and this is where we kind of go from preaching to meddling because we're going to start hitting more people now, is the mind reader marriage. The mind reader marriage is where you don't let your mate finish his conversation, his or her conversation, because you already know what they're going to say. The reason why I didn't tell you about the house being torn down, honey, is I knew what you'd say. The reason why I didn't tell you because I knew what you said. The reason why I didn't say anything about this or that, I already knew what you're going to say. I knew what you do. I knew what you do when I did that. I knew it. We don't give anybody a chance to fail, you see? It's a mind reader marriage. The other part of the mind reader marriage is when you have a hidden agenda. Now, women are better at this than men. I've noticed this. We're going to deal with that next hour. But women are better at this than men. The hidden agenda. It's kind of like, I've got a need, but you don't know what it is. You see, this is an exciting move here. I've got a need, but you don't know what it is. And if you can figure out what it is, then everything's going to be super around the ranch in the next few days. Okay, but if you can't figure out what it is, it's going to be bad around here for weeks. You see, it's a hidden agenda. And let me tell you something about men. I'm going to give you more of this next hour, but I got to slip it in now because some of you look like you could fade here, and I don't want to hurt the women too badly. But let me tell you about men. Men do not pick up clues very well. Have you noticed that, women? Yep. They do not pick up clues. You can drop clues all over the place. They don't pick them up. Man is an interesting creature. He can stumble all over the truth, get up, wipe himself off, and move on. Don't drop clues. You wonder why he's not meeting your need? I'll tell you why. He doesn't know what it is. He doesn't have the foggiest notion what's going on. Man doesn't know. He's an ignorant so-and-so. You thought that, but it's true. Man doesn't know. Don't drop clues. The mind reader marriage does not work. The next battleground that I think is very interesting in how it stirs up trouble is the dictator doormat marriage. Now, this marriage works better than any I know, and let me tell you why. The dictator doormat basically says we've got one person, namely male, who will now think, decide, act, and make all things work. Doormat will lie down, not move, and speak only when spoken to. Now, I want to tell you something. This is used a lot from people who believe in the Bible. But they twist the Bible around and twist it out of there in a very strange way. And they misinterpret, I believe, what's going on there. It's wrong, but it's the most efficient of all for one person. Okay, not for two, but for one. It's the most efficient of all. If you've only got one person thinking, there's nobody to argue with. If you've only got one person talking, there's nobody to deal with at all. So it's the most efficient of all. It will work. Not good for two, but really good for one. So if you can con somebody into lying down and just kind of, hey, do what I tell you, you got a great marriage on your hands, all right? Great marriage. No life, nobody to talk to, but a great marriage. Dictator doormat. It does not work. The next is what I call the parent-child marriage. The parent-child marriage is where, you know, your most significant relationship that you have, the most significant one you have as you're growing up, is the opposite sex. In other words, if you're a boy, your most significant relationship is with mom because she's mothered you. If you're a girl, usually the most significant relationship is from dad who has mothered you, all right? And as you grow up, what happens is you find somebody, especially the most significant opposite sex relationship, you find someone to relate to that's much like mom or much like dad. So many women will end up marrying their fathers, you see, and many men, and this is more part of it, that's not too many women do that, more men do this though. Many men, I'm giving you a lot of insight on men today, aren't I? Kind of exciting. Many men, we'll get to the root of the problem here in a moment, the women, but many men marry their mothers. And as they marry their mothers, they then become the mischievous child, you see, trying to get away with things. And mother is the nagging mother, saying, "You're not going to do that, Johnny." And they never become lovers. They never become related this way. But they basically have the parent-child relationship. The best way to stop it. This is so simple, it's almost incredible. You shouldn't pay a dime for this advice right here. This is free. If you think that's what's going on in your marriage, just call it like it is and say, "Honey, I don't want to be your child anymore." Now, she'll die in a pile there at first, but let her have her little fit. And then you say, "And I don't want you to be my mother." And kind of laugh a little bit, try to get it a little lighter. And she'll say, "I did not ever do that. I would not. And she goes through all kinds of questions. That's okay. She'll think about that, and it works. If you have married your father and you think he's acting like father all the time and not trusting you and not respecting you and all that, you say, "Hey, I don't want to be married to my father. I want to be married to you. Therefore, I will not be your little girl anymore. I will be your wife." And he will, of course, move into his denial, and he doesn't talk as much about it. He kind of gets hurt. And then it gets to be very exciting, but it quits. They stop. It all stops. Another one where I know most of you live is the passive men, wild women marriage. Passive men, wild women. Now, the passive men, wild women marriage is a really exciting. I mean, this is where people live. We're talking mega here. I mean, this is really where it is. Husband, his main goal in life, after he gets through with the day, his main goal is to tune out when he gets home. He wants to tune out. He's had it with people. The main goal of the woman, especially if she's been around with the threes and the four-year-olds, she wants to be with a human being sometime tonight. Okay? So what she does is she wants to tune in. Now, we have a real out-of-sync relationship. He can't wait to get home tune out and to just throw it off and say, "Gee, so good to be back in my shelter, my haven. I don't have to deal with anybody at all." And then here she is. Can't wait to tune in. Do you know that most problems in marriage happen right here during this pit hour? Very bad time of day. I call it the Valley of the Shadow. It's a very bad scene. Because somebody's going to die there. You just know it. You can just feel it. More arguments happen there because of one thing. People are out of sync. He comes home wanting to tune out. She wants to tune in. A horrible scene. And what's interesting is this. When he gets more silent and becomes more passive, what's that make her do? Become more wild, you see. She goes berserko now. And she says, "Why don't you talk to me? You never talk to me." And of course, in this atmosphere, he's not about to say a word. And when she goes wilder, it makes him go more passive. And so both of them split right out the door. Another battleground that puts it into another different kind of perspective is the crowded marriage. The crowded marriage could be crowded by three different entities. One is in-laws, when you have too many parents around, in-laws involved in the marital relationship. And as the in-laws get involved, you're too dependent upon them. They're telling you how to take care of your children. They're putting all kinds of pressure in there. One mate sides with his parents, or the wife sides with her parents, and it gets to be very exciting. That can be a crowded marriage. Another crowded marriage would be where you are kid-centered. I find a lot of marriages are kid-centered. Now, you don't have them around long, right? That's the rationale. They're not going to be around long, so let's give them all we got now. And let's center everything we have on these children. We'll make it kid-centered. Everything we do when we take retreats, when we're going to get away, when we're on a vacation, we want to make sure that the kids are there all the time in between us. That's very important to set up a wonderful relationship later. And because you'll have a lot of time to figure out what to do with your relationship because you won't have anybody there. And when you focus in on the kids, they leave, you have nothing back here. I find that when a husband says, hey, honey, let's get away for the weekend, the first response is, what about the kids? I mean, gee, they may fall apart. They could get into drugs while we're gone. Well, yeah, they could have gotten in drugs while you're gone. But you know what happens to the kids? When you come back after a weekend, you know what they say? Mom, Dad, we had a terrific time. Could you go again next week? Isn't it interesting? We're so concerned about the kids, and yet they get very excited about that. A crowded marriage. There's another crowd in this crowded marriage, and that's when a third party comes into the deal. When a third party comes in. And I find that third parties, most of the time, a third party is just, it doesn't make any difference what her name is or what his name is. It's because there's a person that has a lonely gut. A lonely magnet on the inside, and they're dying for a relationship with somebody, and they've not had it. And they're looking desperately for somebody who will give that threat of a relationship, who will give that threat of appreciation, of respect, anything that feels like a warm, fuzzy relationship. They're looking for it, and that loneliness hurts so badly, and so they're just looking for somebody else. And you know what? There are a lot of somebodies out there who are looking for the same thing. And so these two magnets just come together. Oh, hi there. I'm lonely. Hey, me too. And one starts counseling the other, which is the most devastating thing of all. Don't ever counsel anybody. Let the counselors do that. Because counselors always run off with the person they're counseling with. Because it's an amazing thing what happens there. Because man and woman have this chemistry thing. You see, man is basically physical. I'm going to give you a little anatomy thing here now. Man is basically physical. Woman is basically emotional. And if you want to get inside that man and make him feel like he's loved, you've got to relate to him physically. Physically. And you relate to him physically, then he feels loved. That's man. Woman, in order to get inside woman, you've got to relate to her emotionally. You've got to get in there and say, oh, yeah, wow. Oh, I never thought of it that way. That's true. That's good. Oh, I'm so glad. And you hurt that badly. And it was that, oh, wow, you've got to get in there and moan a lot. I mean, you've got to get in there and empathize. You've got to empathize with what's going on. I mean, you've really got to empathize. And you open her right up. Now, a counselor gets in. Here's a male counselor, female, in for counseling. And he is groaning and moaning, saying, oh, wow, that is horrible. I'm so sorry you live with that, Claude. This is a bad scene. I don't see how you've made it this long. And then she starts feeling this emotional pull on her. And she's thinking, oh, I think I'm in love with this guy. And as soon as the session is over, she comes up, gives him a big hug and a kiss. And he says, good night, we are in love. And they're gone, just like that, you see. A crowded marriage. And many times it happens because people are so lonely, looking for somebody to meet their need. They're just looking for temporary fast pain relief. That's all. Looking for temporary fast pain relief. It doesn't make any difference what the person's name is. It doesn't make any difference who they are, what they're all about. They need something desperate. The crowded marriage. The next one is the empty marriage. The empty marriage happens in two ways. When the kids grow up, and you've surrounded your whole life around the kids. I'm not saying ignore your kids. This could be bad. I'm not saying throw them out and say, hey, sorry, guys, fend for yourself. We do that with our third child, I think, a lot. The first child, you're panicky, and you, oh, my gosh, they got a diaper wrong or something, or maybe it's on jagged, or, I mean, something's wrong here. The pin's sticking in. Second one, you say, oh, it couldn't be anything bad. And the third one, you say, put the diaper on yourself, kid, you know. But it's when we focus so much on the kids, and then they're gone, and you have nothing. But there's another one, and it's this age-old midlife crisis. Everybody's got to have one, at least. Okay, you're allowed one. I mean, that's kind of the end thing to do. You need at least one midlife crisis. Everybody should have one. I'm just giving you freedom to have at least one. Some have more than one, I've noticed lately. But a midlife crisis happens like this. For the woman, She is needed, always needed. She's got kids coming along. The PTA wants her. The school wants her. The civic clubs want her. The church wants her. Everybody, scouts want her. I mean, everybody wants this woman. She is so needed to give everything out to somebody else. Always giving, 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 giving. She is needed. Now the kids leave. PTA doesn't give a rip anymore. Too old for a lot of the civic clubs. I mean, you're passing on. Nobody to take anywhere in the taxi cab that you have developed over the years, because they always want to go that way. You've had all these talents you've developed, like driving and things like that, and nobody cares anymore. And all of a sudden, you as a woman wake up and you say, hey, wait a minute. I have done all of this for everybody else all my life, and now I'm going to do something for me. That's right. For me. The man goes through the same kind of thing. He has been climbing the corporate ladder. I mean, he is trying to pull off the real coup of coups. And as he's moving up the corporate ladder, and what's really dangerous is he finds out sometimes it's been leaning against the wrong building all along, but we won't get to that now. We'll get to that later. But he's climbing the corporate ladder, and he's trying to make a success of himself and do it so well, and he finds that either he's not going to make it or he makes it, one way or the other. But he sees that he's given and given and given and given. He's basically a paycheck. He just keeps giving and giving and dropping it in. Nobody appreciates him. They just count on him. That's all. And so after he wakes up and says, wait a minute, hold it. I've been giving and giving and giving and giving for everybody, paying for everything. We got the house, we got the toys, we got the cars, we got the machines, we got all the stuff. I do all this stuff to clothe you and feed you, and you know, it's kind of a long story after a while. And I clothe you and feed you, and now, hey, I found out something. It's time I did something for me. Now, the empty marriage happens when these two people follow the advice of most magazines today. And the advice is, go find yourself. Now you think about that for a second. Go find yourself. I love that one. Go find yourself. And so what we have is we have a world of people chasing themselves. And they never find themselves. That comes out of that empty nest. The next one is the career marriage. This is a good one. Usually you wake up to this one when you are dealing with the woman's career. We don't think about it with men, but we're going to think about it here for a moment with men. The career marriage. You can either be a career person or a person with a career. Big difference. If you're a career person, then you're already married to a career. And now you have something else going on called marriage on the side. If you're a person with a career, then you're a person who may or may not be married, and you happen to have this career. It's a big, big difference. Many women will come to me and say, do you think it's okay for a woman to have a career? And they're usually trying to trick me. And I'll say, of course, I think it's a terrific thing, but don't be a career woman. Don't be a career woman. Well, what about the man? He shouldn't be a career man either. Because a career man means I'm married to somebody else. I'm married to something else. And because I'm married to something else, I can't give adequate and proper attention to this thing called marriage. Therefore, it doesn't work. Do you know what has destroyed more marriages? The outside force that's destroyed more marriages and more family makeup has been destroyed by this one thing. It's industrialization. The industrialization society. Every society that goes through industrialization, what happens is the dad is outside the home completely. And as he's outside the home, he's married to the business. He doesn't have adequate time to be with the family, with his wife, doesn't even know who he is. He's basically a businessman. He works for whatever. And if you even notice, a lot of the bigger companies, they all dress that way. We could have fun here today looking through and saying, I'll bet I know what you do. Because ministers look a certain way. They've all got their hair, you know, in a certain drink. If I had enough, I'd do that. But you can find different people with different corporations. They look that way. You can tell an accountant. You can tell a real estate agent. He's usually unemployed. And you can see a lot of these people because you can kind of tell them. They kind of fall into that page because they've married it. A career marriage doesn't work. It doesn't work. You must have a marriage that has a career or two careers, but you cannot have a career marriage. It just doesn't work. The tenth battleground is I'm not in love anymore marriage. I love you, but I'm not in love. I love that. I'm not in love. I hear this constantly from people. And it's supposed to be the greatest excuse of all not to stay in this marriage anymore. Because you see, I really love her, but I'm not in love. You see, and they kind of, their eyebrow kind of, love. Shish. What they want is a honeymoon relationship. They want a honeymoon relationship. They want it to be like it was before. It isn't going to be like it was before. And because they're not growing in the relationship, they're not communicating, they're not keeping communication up to date with one another, then what happens is they're looking for something that will be a lot more exciting than what we got now. So they want another honeymoon relationship. So they're looking for some kind of whipped cream relationship, not the substance, but something that's kind of whipped cream that says, boy, we have the pizzazz now, huh? And then they get through with that one, and the pizzazz goes out of that relationship, and they look for the next pizzazz one, you see, because it's not for real. The last battleground is the great sex reversal marriage. The great sex reversal marriage. I find that today more men are acting like women and women acting like men because we've got great confusion on our hands of what is male and what is female. Now, I'm going to give you a few little things here that's kind of heretical, but I'm going to give them to you anyway because I think you can take it. You look like you can handle this. Here we go. Inside every man is an inner female. Inside every man is an inner female. An inner female quality that's warm, relational, giving, sensitive, caring, relational. Inside every woman is an inner male. And this inner male is directed toward goals, driving, moving toward accomplishing things and getting those things done. Inner male. Now, when that inner female of the man or the inner male of the woman gets out of control, let me describe what happens. It gets to be very exciting. When a man has a female attack, that's what I call the inner female taking over, he gets moody. He gets really moody. He gets really down or he gets really high, one or the other. But he's not normal. And he gets moody. He gets really down. Oh, things are bad or things are just great. Now, what he does in a mood is nothing can get him out of the mood. Nothing. Nobody. And here's what the woman wants to do. She wants to rescue him from his mood. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't get near him. Think of him as having a terminal case of a female attack. You don't want to get near him because he's possessed. This man is possessed. He is possessed by his inner female. And in this possessed mood, nothing can get him out. You have to just say, go have your attack on your own. I'm not going to get near you. Call me when you're through. Here's what he does. He'll go buy toys many times. He'll buy toys. Now, I'm just going to ask you women one question. Have you noticed this in your neighborhood someplace? Yeah, all right. Okay. A lot of you don't have much guts. But he buys toys. He'll go out. You know what I do when I have a female attack? I get cameras. I love cameras. Never use them. Just buy them. I'm going behind the Iron Curtain soon, and I got a little camera not long ago. I'm so excited about it. And I'm sure it works. They told me it did. But I just go out and buy things. I'll buy things, come home, just make me feel good right there. I had a female attack and came home and it's okay now, honey. It's all right. I'm back. Now, I've saved the best to last. The woman. The woman, when she has an inner male attack, she becomes argumentative, judgmental, critical, opinionated. I've got a lot to tell you here, but I can't go on. There is no way you can win. She is for the juggler, and it's your juggler. Now, men, in your neighborhood, have you noticed this happening anywhere? One man, yeah, you brave man. Well, that happens. And if your woman is having a male attack, don't try to rescue her. Because what happens is you move into your inner female to try to reach out sensitively. But you find out she's not responding. So then you have a female attack. So if she's having a male attack, you're having a female attack, and we call this hell. It's two people who are possessed trying to work something out. It doesn't work that way. You see, basically, men, most men, think first and feel second. Most women feel first and think second. Therefore, when you ask a husband a question, when you ask your man this question, you say, "How do you feel about this, honey?" You get nothing. Well, I think that... And then a lot of you women think your husband has no feeling. You start to think, you know, I don't think the guy's got a feeling in his body. He gets excited about baseball, but that's it. About his toys. Don't ask your husband. In most cases, don't ask your husband, "How do you feel?" Don't ask him that. Ask him first, "What do you think?" Then ask him, "How do you feel?" Get him to think first, and then go to the feeling. The woman, women, most women, feel first and think second. Don't ask a woman, "What do you think about this?" Don't ask her that. When you ask her what she thinks about something, you know what she'll do? She'll tell you. And you don't want to hear it that way. Most women, what you've got to do, most women, you must ask them, "How do you feel about this, honey?" Get the feelings out. Get those feelings out. Get them out. Pull them out of there. And then say, "And what do you think about it?" Now you get a wealth. I have a little theory I'm going to share with you. I believe since women think second and men feel second, I think that's their innermost core of being. And I see women as having a great amount of wisdom, more wisdom than man ever thought about having. I see woman as absolutely bursting inside with wisdom. That's why when you try your business deal out, you try it on her, right? And she gives you all these wonderful ideas that you get credit for all year long. And she's the one that set this up. I know my wife writes my material and I deliver it every week. They have all this wisdom. And in order to tap it, you must get the feelings out first and then get down to that well of wisdom. But men, on the other hand, men have this well of emotion. Do you know who gets hurt worse in a divorce? The man. The man gets hurt worse than the woman every time. It's deeper and lasts longer. Now, some of you women might argue with that, but over and over, the studies are showing the man is the one who hurts longer and really much deeper because he's got this great well of emotion. And your man has it, even though you haven't seen a flicker of it. He's got it in there. And you've got to get him to talk and get the thinking out and then get down and dip down into that well and you find out what's going on. I was in one of my offices at Coco's the other day. It's a little... little coffee shop, and I was at the third booth to the left where I'm often there counseling and dealing with people, and this couple came in and sat down with me, and she was telling me how this guy was so into his business, and he'd married that, and he'd married the athletic events and all this. He's at a great, successful company, and she was just telling me how this guy was this and that and the other. He didn't have a chance to talk. And as I listened to this scene, she was just pouncing on him and pouncing on him. And finally I said, "Hold it, lady. Hold it. Don't say another word. I can't stand it any longer." She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Don't you see what you're doing with this man? This man is hurting desperately. He's hurting down inside, and you're just penetrating and hurting him and stabbing him. And this man is hurting. You've hurt him." She looked at me and she said, "Him? Are you kidding me? No way. No way could I hurt him." We both looked over at him, and tears were coming down his face, starting to break into a cry. She looked at him, and she looked back at me, and she said, "I think I hurt him." I said, "That's what I told you, lady." She said, "I've never seen him like this before." It's because she hadn't understood the difference between maleness and femaleness, and she was unwilling to pull it out of him because it's in there. Otherwise, it's a horrible battleground. But there's such a wealth of material inside. And he spoke, and he said, "I've been hurting for years, but I haven't been able to express it. And you're the first person that's ever told me, and especially now, to say I would hurt." He said, "I'd never admit that I hurt." Every time you get into a conflict with your mate, you remember, no matter how angry they may be, no matter how forceful they may be, no matter what they're throwing your way, literally, They're hurting so desperately on the inside. You got to get beyond that to where the person is. Now, we've seen these 11 battlegrounds and what tears a marriage down. So in light of that, what makes a marriage distinctive? There's a chapter in the Bible in Romans chapter 1 that says something very interesting. It's almost like a historical survey, and I get a lot of principles as I read, and especially in that book because it has some incredible things to say. And it says there in this historical survey that there are three movements of every civilization. And as I've read history, it's true. Every time man gets confused on who God is, the second movement is he's confused about who he is, his maleness and femaleness. The third thing that happens is he gets confused about relationships then. So it's a fuzzy knowledge of God, and then a fuzzy knowledge and of identity of who I am, and then a fuzziness and a blurriness in my relationships. And every civilization, every great civilization that's gone right down the tubes has gone down the tubes where there was no distinction between men and women. There was no distinction between men and women. It was basically unisex. That's the way we are. Each one's a person. Everybody's equal. Everybody is equal, but not everyone is the same. And that's where we've messed up with this equality movement. How do you make your marriage distinctive? I'd put it this way. You make your marriage distinctive by turning your ritual, your games, your roles into a relationship. You turn your ritual and your roles and your games into a relationship with your mate by creatively loving three people. Let me give them to you. You turn your ritual into a relationship by creatively loving three people. Number one, by creatively loving God. Now, I'm not talking about the religious system of do's and don'ts. Nobody likes that. I've turned off of that long time ago. I remember when I was growing up, I was looking to find my ticket to get into heaven, and I'd heard that they gave them at the Baptarian Church, which is right across the street from the Presbyterus, down the road from the Episcopalics. And I went in there, and I said, how do I get my ticket to get in? I wanted to get in. And I found that they had a list of things you couldn't do in life, and those things that you couldn't do, if you didn't do those, you could get your ticket. I was so excited. I looked at that list. It had 12 things, all printed up. As I looked at the list, I realized that those lists that I wasn't allowed to do in order to get my ticket, I realized those were my goals in life. That bothered me a lot right there. So I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about the minister that's always talking about God. I'm talking about a relationship with God where you creatively love God, creatively search for your maker, and worship Him, and love Him, and relate to Him. That's number one, in order to turn your ritual, roles, games, into a relationship. Secondly, by creatively loving yourself. People don't like to love themselves. I'm going to give you permission right now. You can and must love yourself. A great person once said that you must love your neighbor as you love yourself. Therefore, if you don't love yourself, your neighbor's in a heap of trouble. See? Now, you must love yourself. I heard something. I love this. Hang on to your seats. When your father deposited sperm into your mother to go after your mother's egg, there were approximately 2 billion sperm after that egg. And you won. Think of it! You beat 2 billion people out in this foot race for the egg. You ought to stand right up, go into the office and say, I'll tell you what. Creatively loving yourself and then creatively loving your mate. Make your marriage distinctive. By turning your ritual into a relationship, by creatively loving God, someone higher than us, outside us. Secondly, by creatively loving yourself. And thirdly, by creatively loving your mate. A man went to a marriage seminar for lunch. He was so convicted about what he'd been doing wrong that he came home and he had his box of candy and he had a piece of jewelry and he had some flowers, and he pulled out the flowers and he said, "Honey, I love you," and gave her a big hug, and he gave her the jewelry and he said, I love you, honey, I need you," and gave her the candy, and again gave her a big hug and said, "I love you and need you and desperately want to be with you the rest of my life." And she starts crying. She says, "Oh my gosh, it's so bad. It's so horrible. I can't believe it's so bad." He said, "What's so bad?" She said, "Well, the toilet overflowed this morning. The sink stopped up. Johnny broke his leg. The dog was run over. And now you've come home drunk." In a way, that's what I'm saying you got to do. Is you got to get caught up in this relationship. Get rid of the roles. Get rid of this rigmarole of games and rituals and things you must go through because I'm married, I must do this. And get into life. Let me close with this story. It really says it. There was a 4-year-old girl playing with about a 3-year-old boy, not quite 3. They were playing house, and she was the wife and he was the husband. And they decided they would go next door to see if they could visit the neighbor lady. And so they walked up hand in hand and rang the doorbell. And as they did that, the lady came to the door and she said, "Hello there." And the little girl said, "Hi, this is my husband and I am his wife. And we're playing house. We thought we'd come over for some lemonade and cookies." The lady of the house said, "Do come in." They came in, sat on the couch. She gave them lemonade, cookies. Then they talked a while. She said, "Would you like some more lemonade and some more cookies?" The little girl said, "No, thank you. We've got to go now because my husband just wet his pants." You know what I think? I think as long as you play the games, and as long as you play the ritual and the roles in your relationship, as long as you keep your relationship a ritual, a game, and don't turn it into a relationship, the best thing you can ever expect in your marriage is somebody's going to wet their pants. Thank you.